So Yaakov comes back to, he makes his way back to the land of Israel, and there's a problem. The problem is that the same reason, or at least one of the reasons that he left. So let's go back and try to get a little bit of context, and then perhaps we'll be able to understand some of what has happened. When Yaakov left, he left for two reasons. Right? When he left the land of Israel, he left for two reasons. He left because his mother told him to, and he left because his father told him to. But like everything else in the dysfunctional Jewish family, they didn't tell him to leave for the same reason. Meaning, even when they agreed, they didn't agree, which is important. Yitzhak, who was manipulated by Rivka, when she got very dramatic and she said, you know, if Yaakov marries girls, like Canaanite girls like Esav did, then my life is over and I have no reason to live, and so on and so forth. So Yitzchak, of course, then obeys his wife, calls him in, and sends him off to marry a nice girl back from the Laban family. On the other hand, Rivka had called him in and said, you better get out of here, you better leave, because your brother wants to kill you. Of course, she didn't come out and say that really clearly to Yitzchak. Probably she wanted to be as, she didn't want to be all that involved in that, because if she did, then perhaps her entire role in this episode would have come to light, which was not necessarily what she had wanted at that point. So that's the background. Now, if I look at the two goals that Yaakov had in front of him, so one of them he accomplished, and you know, extraordinarily well in terms of finding a shidduch. That was a complete success. Not only did he find one shidduch, he came back with four, which is, you know, at least three more than most do. So, you know, we can put, he gets a gold star, maybe four gold stars next to the shidduch box. On the other hand, when it comes to the danger, Rivka had said to him, go away for a few days, yomim achadim, go away for a few days, and when your brother's anger dissipates, then I'll send for you. So first of all, when anybody in the Lavan family, including Lavan and including Rivka, they talk about numbers, you have to be careful. You know, work for a week, stay for a week, go for a few days, and no thing. You have to be very careful because they tend to exaggerate in their favor when they use time. This is Jewish time on steroids. And we're not all that sure that Rivka ever did, in fact, send. There is a Rashi later on in the Parsha that talks about the death of Devorah Menekes Rivka. It says that she died. She's one of the few people who dies that we never knew that she was alive. At least it never mentions her by name before. So, I mean, this is great. She died. But what did she do? We don't know. So there we have some sort of challenge, even though we're told that when Rivka came to meet Yitzchak, we're told that the family did send with her somebody. And so presumably we will follow the age-old tradition of the theory of conservation of characters in Tanakh. So therefore, this woman is the same woman as then. But the fact that she died, really, why is this significant? So the Midrash, which Rashi cites, creates an entire narrative that she was the one, because she came back from the old town, she was the one that Rivka sent to tell him that he can come back. Now, that's a very nice interpretation. Again, it's not there. And all that it says is that the woman died. So now, not only did she die, we gave her a mission. So there was information flowing back and forth between the Yitzchak Rivka home and the Yaakov home, and the one who was responsible for this was this Devorah. So if that's the case, then everything is good. Yaakov come home, and so on and so forth. And if Yaakov come home, because Esav is no longer upset, so then there's nothing to be afraid of. Now, all that is very nice, except for one thing. And what's that? Yaakov's afraid. So why is Yaakov afraid? Yaakov's afraid because the last time he saw his brother said he was going to kill him. So now, again, real simple question. As time has moved on... Okay, so, right. So, correct. Esav is more respectful than the sons of Yaakov, because Yaakov's sons, when they're ready to kill Yosef, don't even care that Yaakov's still alive. Esav has more kivud av, so therefore he respects his father, so he won't kill his brother till his father's dead. The only problem is that over the years, does he remember this or not? And over the years, has his anger dissipated, or has his anger built up? And that's an interesting question which we, as of this moment, have no ability to answer. But we do know one thing about anger, and that is that you can have certain triggers for anger. when something can happen which can suddenly trigger it. So just for example, let's just say that Esav lives in poverty from the moment that Yaakov gets those brachas, and Esav's life is terrible. And let's just say, for argument's sake, he sees Yaakov coming with a great deal of wealth. Could that be a trigger? Right, right. So I'm just pointing out that even though maybe Esav has calmed down, maybe he hasn't calmed down. And when you have a trigger, then you just may pull the trigger. And that's the and that's the problem that we have right now. Yaakov, for his part, again, I don't have to read into anything. Yaakov, for his part, is indeed quite afraid. How do we know it? Because it says it. It says that he really is quite afraid, and that's our problem. Now, what I want to do is I want to try to read some of this introduction, but then we're going to constantly go back because, as I keep saying, context over here is important. But Yishlach Yaakov Malachim, Yaakov says Malachim. What does Rashi say, Malachim?
Malachim.
Right? Mamish Malachim. Right? Mashiach, Mamish. Right? He sends almost Yutes Kislev. That's why we read this now. Yaakov sends real angels. Now, why Rashi had to say that, I'm not clear. I'm not sure. On the other hand, last week's parish in Vayetse, we were not lacking angels. We had angels going up and angels coming down. We had angels in the beginning of the parsha, angels at the end of the parsha. We're full of angels. So over here we have another set of angels. One thing is that if you're going to send people to go and to check out how Esav is doing, it's definitely better to send angels than to send someone else, because angels have nine lives. I don't know that. But it's harder to kill an angel than to kill somebody who's in your family or your entourage. So sending the angels is an excellent idea. Kol hakavod to Yaakov. Yishlach Yaakov melachim lefanav leisav achiv. So the first thing we note is, it didn't have to say, right? It didn't have to say achiv, his brother. So Yaakov sends messengers to his brother. So again, from Yaakov's perspective, there is this idea of brotherhood, and Yaakov's hoping that there's a sense of brotherhood. Aretz Seir Sdei Edom. Now that itself is very interesting, because he's in a place called Seir, which means that he's not in Eretz Canaan. He has moved, you know, much further south and east. Correct? Correct.
Not
correct, 100%.
I know, you said, okay.
100%. Agreed. No, agreed. Vayitzav otam lemar, and he commands his angels, saying, Ko tamrum la adoni la Esav, ko amar avdecha Yaakov, im lavan garti veichar ad ata. Now, those of us who were brought up in yeshiva and we were taught this Rashi, the Rashi on this pasuk, so the most important element we were told, im lavan garti v'taryag mitzvah shamarti, meaning that that's the most important thing, is that Yaakov comes and says to Esav, don't worry, I'm very frum. This is the important thing that you should know. I still keep the taryag mitzvah. The only question is, have you ever kept the taryag mitzvah? I mean, I don't want to overstep the bounds of a class I gave last night, but given that he kept taryag mitzvah, it's a little difficult to explain how he married two sisters. Just for example, and I know the Ramban. You're a Zionist. Because everybody knows outside of Eretz Yisrael, you don't have to keep the Torah. And then I just came back from America, and I saw that that's the case. Okay. But you do appreciate that the Ramban's explanation is not that strong. Okay. But we focus on the guy. I mean, again, that's what happens. Again, when we study this pasuk, that's the main thing. In Lovan Garti, look at Rashi, in the second line of Rashi, Dover Acher Garti beGematria Taryag. Now that's such a good gematria, because you don't have to take away, you don't have to add one, take away one, and it's the same letters. It's just an anagram. It's the same thing. And Garti is Taryag, so it jumps out at you, and every kid remembers that, and it's great. Klomer im lovan harosha garti v'taryag mitzvot shamarti v'lo lamadati b'ma'asav haraim. So this is great, because especially you want to educate your children or your students, so you tell them it doesn't make a difference where you live or what kind of atmosphere. You still have a responsibility of keeping the Torah, and look how Yaakov was successful, and you get to give musar, which is always important. But did you all notice that wasn't Rashi's first explanation? So let's now go back to Rashi's first explanation, and then let's try to understand the pasuk, because by doing this, we completely missed what is going on. Garti, lo na'asiti sar v'chashuv elager, eincha kedai l'sno oti al brachot avicha shebrachani havagvir la'achecha shre lo nitkaima bi. Now that is a much more powerful interpretation than the second one is, and I will explain. He says, in Lavan Garti, I was a stranger. I was a stranger. I never sunk roots over there. I never felt comfortable over there. I was a person who has not become somebody who's well established and important and so on. And therefore, again, and now notice the words, therefore don't hate me because the bracha that I took from you, or could we say stole, misappropriated, I'm scared already what I should say, the bracha which Yaakov somehow got miraculously that was destined for Esav, that bracha Yaakov is saying, don't be upset with me, because it hasn't helped me at all. Now, there's a couple of other layers in the verse itself which we need to pay attention to. One is, look at the way he addresses him. He calls him La Adoni La Esav Ko Amar Avdecha Yaakov. Now, in order to pay attention, what was the bracha that he took? So look at source number two. This is the bracha. This was the bracha that was destined for, or Yitzchak thought was destined for Esav. And this was the one that Rivka thought was terribly important. Now, I don't know how to finish the sentence. So I will admit I don't know how to finish the sentence, and you can help me, but not now. Is it that Rivka thought that it was terribly important that Yaakov get this bracha? Or did Rivka think it was terribly important that Esav not get this bracha? Okay, that actually is a very important question within this entire parsha or parshiot. Was it that Esav can't have this bracha, or that Yaakov needs this bracha? Because if Yaakov needs the bracha, then I have news for you. I'm not convinced it ever happened. I'm not convinced that Yaakov ever really did get this bracha. And I want to pause here for a second. In Parsha Toldot, we have two sons, two parents, two brachot that become three brachot. Right. So I'm saying there's two brachot which become three brachot, but the confusion here is that Yitzchak has love for Esav. We find this very difficult. Now the reason we find this difficult is because we're biased. And why are we biased? Because we are descendants of Yaakov. So of course we're biased. There's another level to the bias. Right. Right. Okay. So I'll come back to both of those points in a second. That was early. I needed that a little bit later on in the class, but I'll let you know when I needed that. Okay. The timing was a little off on that. Okay. Let's go back a second. We need to be careful because Esav in Tanakh, or let's be more careful, Esav in the Chumash is not as bad as Esav is in the Midrash. There's actually three different Esavs. There's Esav in the Chumash, Esav in the Navi, and Esav in Midrash and Agadah. Whenever Esav is mentioned, we need to be careful. Are we talking about the biblical Esav, the son of Yaakov? Are we talking about the one who the prophets speak about, which is much more identified with Rome? Or are we talking about Christianity? Which means when Chazal speak about Esav, you need to know who's speaking and when they're speaking in order to know what they mean. Rome was not loved by the Jews. On the other hand, Rome was in charge and was very difficult to speak about Rome. So therefore, you know what I would say, Navi. I'll restate that. In the Midrash, it's really talking about Rome. I'll restate that. Yes, that when the Midrash wants to say something about the Romans who are in charge, Second Temple period, post-Second Temple period, so they'll describe Edom, they'll call them Malchut Edom. Edom is, of course, one of the names of Esav. So they associate this bloodthirsty, murderous people with Esav, because here you have a biblical character that you can correct it to. Whether there's any kind of genealogical connection or not, that would be far more surprising. But that is how they understand it. And at some point, the greatest revenge we take against the Romans is we give them Christianity, and we, right? That's revenge that we take against them. You're going to destroy our temple, we're going to give you guilt for the next 2,000 years. Okay? So eventually, Rome morphs into Christianity, but still what you have over here, again, depending who's speaking and when, is it Rome, Christianity, and so on, but you have this whole, it's a character more than it is a real historical individual, and you have to be careful when and where the source is found. Esav in the Chumash, he's not a good guy, but he's not as bad as we make him sound. Again, he comes in from the field, and it says that he comes in, he asks Yaakov for food, and so on. So the rabbis have him coming in from a day of murder, rape, and any other sins you can imagine, and a couple you couldn't imagine. So they put all of that on him, because that makes sense in terms of Rome, it makes sense in terms of the people that they know, but does it really make sense in the Psukim? So that's something we probably need to be a little more careful of. Does Yitzchak know? Does Yitzchak know that Esav is not, you know, is not where he should bank on in terms of his future? Of course Yitzchak knows this. So you can say, how do I know that Yitzchak knows it? So very simple. Just follow the brachot. I mean, that's, by the way, it's the theme of everything this year. Follow the brachot. Look which bracha he wanted to give Esav, and look at which bracha he wanted to give to Yaakov. And on top of that is what my mother said before, is the very awkward verse. We're told in order that on the one hand that they have two sons, right? One son is an Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. So here's a really hard question. If you're Yitzchak and you have a son who's an Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim, you have a son who's a simple person and sits in the tents, who should he remind you of? Your father? So unless you want to say that there was an Oedipal relationship between Yitzchak and Avram, and he couldn't stand Avram, he wanted to kill Avram, therefore he hated Yaakov, so I will let the Freudians among you to decide the merit in that argument. I don't believe it for a second. And as I said, what's my biggest proof? Follow the bracha. Look at the bracha that he gives to Yaakov. When he knows that it's Yaakov, what bracha does he give him? He gives him Berachos Avraham. Why does he give Yaakov Berachos Avraham? Because Yaakov is the closest thing to Avram in his life. It's very simple. He was a man of the tents, and he was a man of the tents. This is not a very difficult analysis or an analogy. On the other hand, he has another son, and his other son is described as a hunter, as a great hunter. There's only one other hunter at that point in the Torah. Who's the only other hunter who's mentioned? Nimrod. Nimrod. Nimrod was not a good guy, and that's why they called him Nimrod. Nimrod was a bad guy. Of course, it's far more, there's far greater irony. According to the rabbinic understanding, Nimrod tries to kill Avraham. Nimrod tries to kill Avraham. Now, if Nimrod tries to kill Avraham, it could be that Yitzchak should be somewhat alerted. Hold it a second. Does that mean that Esav will try to kill Yaakov one day? So I'm just saying that there's just some real interesting foreshadowing when he looks at his two kids. One's a hunter, and one's like a Nimrod, and the other one is like Avraham. So this should be real easy. Now, of course, the whole problem is that God messed up the whole story here. Rivka was pregnant. Rivka is very disturbed because, first of all, she's very disturbed. She's gone at least 20 years of being married, and now she's pregnant, and she doesn't seem to know it's twins. That may actually be the problem. But there's some kind of inner struggle which is taking place. They're struggling. She goes to God to seek out information. Now, all that God had to say to her is, you wanted to get pregnant? Mazel tov. This is what it's like. You know, that's all that he had to say. You want to add to that? Then he could have added on to that. And guess what? You're carrying twins. And that's the whole... But it seems to be, and this is beautifully explained by the Midrash, that one tries to leave by the shuls. I don't know how many shuls there were at that time, but it's the great solution of all problems in Bereishis. So it's the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Aver. Right? Anytime you have a problem, you throw that in, and now you've solved something. So they try to get out by the Beis Medrash of Shem Ve'Aver. Yaakov does, but when you pass by a place of Vodazar, Esav tries to get out. What's the Midrash saying over there? Is that she feels somehow, she intuits that there's some kind of internal struggle over here, and if she's only carrying one child, the child is psychotic. You're schizophrenic. Meaning, there's something wrong. That's what she feels. Don't ask me how. A mother knows, right? Yes. A mother knows. So she feels there's just something wrong over here. So what's God's answer? God's answer is, you're carrying two children. And it would have been very nice if he stopped right then. But then God goes on to what they call today, TMI. Too much information. And God says, and by the way, the older one's going to be a loser. He says it a little nicer than I just said it. But if you're Rivka, now what do? You know, meaning, again, if you knew that one of your kids would really be successful financially, You bank on them. You ignore the other kids, right? Right. I mean, this is the one, but it's more, this is not finances. This is one of spirituality. This is the one that their whole lives were based upon, the values that Yaakov will succeed in having and that Esav will fail. Esav's going to be a failure. Of course, what you have over here is wonderful self-fulfilling prophecy, is Rivka can't talk to him. Rivka can't have any, by the way, there's no relationship between Rivka and Esav at all. And it's two ways. Esav, we know, has a great deal of kivud aim, right? Wrong. Wrong. There's never any kivud aim. It's, you know what's really striking? It says that when he marries his nice Canaanite girls, it was moras ruach to his parents, to Yitzchak and Rivka. They both couldn't stand it. And at the end of the parasha, it says, he saw that his father was upset who he married. Didn't care what his mother felt. Why didn't care what his mother felt? Apparently, he felt. His mother never cared what he felt. Which is over here, again, wonderful.
It says that
I'm going to get to that. I'll get to that. What I'm saying is that we have a wonderful, dysfunctional family over here. And even when it says that Yitzchak loves Esav, that's the most disturbing part of it all, because it says Yitzchak loves Esav, kitzayid befiv. I understand that. I'll explain that to you. He loves him. He loves him kitzayid befiv. And it says, Rivka, ohevis is Yaakov. So what's more normal? Right? I can't explain to you the logic why parents love children or why grandmothers love their grandchildren. I don't understand this. It makes no sense whatsoever. I keep telling all kids are the same. All little babies are the same. And she says, no. My grandchild is
exceptional.
Okay. This isn't logical. This is something which comes on this emotion. And by the way, it's an important emotion that God must give us, otherwise we would kill them when they were very young. Right? This is part of the miracle of survival, is that God makes us love our young. Yes? Yes. Okay. Notice all the mothers are going, yes. Okay. So, that Rivka loves Yaakov, that makes sense. That Yitzchak loves Esav, kitzayid befiv. So, we've spoken about this before, how Rav Hirsch, who did wonderful things for Jewish education, but in this particular instance did terrible things for Jewish interpretation. Rav Hirsch insisted that Yitzchak and Rivka were terrible parents. And they were terrible parents because they gave them both the exact same education. Everything was exactly the same, but it's not true. How do I know it's not true? Because it says that Yitzchak loves Esav kitzayid befiv. Now, I want to explain what this means. Yitzchak is a hunter. Esav is a hunter. What Yitzchak does is he says, let me take the hunting and let me elevate it. Let me take the hunting and let me turn it into a mitzvah. Let me take the hunting and turn it into something which is holy. So how did he take the hunting and turn it into holy? He gives him a tzivoy. He gives him a mitzvah. He says, son, bring me some food. As soon as he said, bring me some food, so now the hunting that he was doing anyway just now became a mitzvah, kivadav. Which means I'd go even further, and I would say that Yitzchak seeing that this is what Esav likes to do, he says, now how will I turn this into something which is holy? And I do want to point something else out that to my mind is absolutely remarkable. It's a statement it's found in the Targum Yonatan, and I'm pretty sure I'd find it in other Midrashim as well, because it's generally the case, that Eliezer, who was the Eved Avram, according to the Targum Yonatan, is Eliezer ben Nimrod. Eliezer, the son of Nimrod. So that itself is fascinating. That means that the muscle in Avraham's house, right, 318 men, that was one guy, it was Eliezer. Why is Eliezer so tough and so strong? He's the son of Nimrod. Now, you have to appreciate the beautiful poetic justice over here. Nimrod tries to kill Avraham, and Avraham survives, and is Makariv his son, and takes his son with him, and takes him back home, and brings him tachas kanfei eshchina, nefesh eshasu b'charon, right? All the people that Avram influences. So now we see that one of the people that he influences is Eliezer, which is not this big surprise, but that the Targum is willing to say that Eliezer is the son of Nimrod, is great. But now I can look back at Yitzchak and say, it's possible to do something with a kid like this. He grew up, there was an Eliezer there. Eliezer was Avraham's muscle. So Esav could end up being Yaakov's muscle, and Esav can be Yaakov's muscle, and somehow they can end up working out together, and let me give holy context to his... So therefore, before he wants to give the bracha, what does he tell Esav? Go out to the field, get some food, bring it back to me, turning the hunting into a mitzvah. As I said, that seems to be a strategy of Esav.
Yeah.
of Yitzchak.
Which is related.
Oh, you're not going to defend her. That's not what he says. But then, no, that's not what the Hirsch said.
He didn't say it.
That's
what he said. Okay.
What
does Rav Hirsch say? Rav Hirsch says that the mistake... Okay, fine. Fine.
And he says you see it when Rivka first sees Yitzchak. She's so off him that she falls off.
Right.
All
right,
sorry.
Right.
So,
Correct. This is a total lack of communication. That's why the marriage was so good. Yes. What Rav Hirsch says is that the mistake of Yitzchak and Rivka is they gave the exact same education to everybody. One generation later, Rav Hirsch's main student, Rav Breuer, will get into a very celebrated argument with Rav Dessler in terms of educational programs. Rav Dessler will say, you need to take all Jewish kids and throw them into the yeshiva system. Out of 1,000, one will succeed and become the Gadol Hador. By the way, you'll have 999 victims. Sacrifices. No, not even necessarily. You have 999 people who are not going to make it, who will be levels of failure, but Rav Dessler says, that's the price we need to pay. Okay, but the guy who's number 2, number 5, number 10, they're going to be really good, but you need, everyone needs to be thrown into this, and one will come out as, that's...
Does that include girls or women?
No.
No.
Rav Hirsch, on the other hand, and in Germany they did have educational programs for women on the one hand, but on the other hand, they had different types of educational programs for different kids. So to a certain extent, Rav Hirsch makes a wonderful educational point, which is, in the context of Yitzchak and Rivka, is completely polemical to the extent that I don't think that it's really a valid interpretation over here. But said, listen. Now, let me go back. Yitzchak, and we have to get back to our parsha at some point. Yitzchak preaches that the two of them will work together. Esav will be the holy hunter. The holy hunter, it sounds like a Kalbach story. He'll be the holy hunter who will bring back food and take care of Yaakov. That's right now Yitzchak, but later on of Yaakov. And he keeps telling, and Yitzchak tells his kids, you're going to work together, you're going to be together, you're going to work together. And Rivka says to Yaakov, not only do they not communicate, they say different things. Rivka says to Yaakov, your brother's a loser, and he's never going to make it, and the whole thing is a facade. So what happens? Esav comes from the field, and what does he say to Yaakov? He says, give me food. By the way, why give me food? He doesn't say, give me food because I'm hungry. He says, give me food because I'm tired, I'm going to die soon. According to the Midrash, that was the day that Avraham died, which clearly says to me he gets into depression. He says, why even bother trying to make believe you're good? Why try to channel all of this? So why try to turn to somebody who's so good? Why try to become an Avraham when even Avraham dies? Which means the first time he meets death of somebody that he loves, he completely falls apart because of the concept of death. Yitzchak then is making, again, they say that he's making food because of the meal after the funeral, Sudas Havra. Yaakov is making the Sudas Havra. I mean, I'd prefer to see that he was making cholent, but whatever. And Esav says, give me food because I'm going to die. Yaakov says, I give you food? That means my mother was right. Because Yitzchak keeps saying that Esav brings the food to Yaakov. So once he says, I have responsibility for you and not the other way around, his mother is right, his father is wrong, and he says, if that's the case, you're not really going to live up to the birthright, you're not really going to be the firstborn, you're not really going to take responsibility, I'll give you the food, I'll take care of you, but you give me the birthright. To which point Esav says, what? I get to get rid of this thing which is, you know, on top of me, weighing down on me. Vayivez Esav Esavachora. He detests being the firstborn. So he gets to get rid of this thing which is weighing down on him, and he gets a bowl of chulin for this. This is the best deal he ever made in his life, and they go and make the deal. From that moment on, okay, a couple things happen. Most important thing that happens is that Yaakov's life gets ruined. Yaakov's life is completely ruined by this, because from this moment on, Yaakov is no longer only Yaakov. Yaakov now is leading two lives. Now he's taken responsibility to live Yaakov's life and to live the life of Esav. Everything else that happens in Yaakov's life is now going to flow from this point. So much so that it could be I'm getting a little crazy, but I even think I can defend Yaakov when he walks into his father and his father says, who are you? He says, I'm Esav Bechorecha. It's true. I'm Esav. I've taken all the responsibilities of Esav. I am now Esav and now I'm Yaakov. I am both. And because he's both, now I can go back to Rivka's mindset, because he's both, he needs both brachot. And I know that I asked that as a question before, but I'm willing to move in that direction. Now, what bracha does he give him? He gives him this bracha of, going back again to source number two, what bracha does he give him? V'yitein l'chalokim mitau ha-shamayim mishmanei aretz v'rov dagon v'tirosh. What's that bracha from? Money. Yavducha amim v'yishtachavu l'cha alumim hevigvir la'achecha v'yishtachavu l'cha b'nei mecha. Power. Money and power are the brachot that he took. Now I could ask you, throughout world history, has this worked? Have the Jews been the most powerful and the Jews been the richest? Very simple question. Has this worked? So...
The world believes it.
Right. I know that's the joke. Why it's always good to read anti-Semitic newspapers, because it makes us feel better. In world history as a whole, has this worked? No, not exactly. Now, here's where it gets interesting. What bracha does he give him? And again, that bracha was destined for Esav. And I don't want to go into this more. There's a lot more to say. But that was destined for Esav. It's given to Yaakov. Yaakov, later on, when he leaves, for the two purposes, his mother and his father calls him in, gives him another bracha, that's source 3. V'yitzel Yitzchak el Yaakov. Now he knows it's Yaakov. V'yavarech eto, v'yitzaveu, v'yomel lo tikach ishim b'not Kanan. The mission that he sends him on, Kum lech padana aram, beta betuel, avi imecha, v'kach l'cham isham, isham ibnot lovan achi imecha. Very specific where he should go and who he should marry. V'kel shakai v'rechotcha, v'yifrcha, v'yirbecha. What bracha does he give? You should have many, many children. V'yitel akalami, v'yitel lechad, v'yirchat avraham, l'chol azarcha, itach, l'rishtacha, it eretz mugurecha, shenotan l'kim l'avraham. He gave him Eretz Yisrael. Which means, there's two different sets of brachot. Power and money. Land of Israel and children. Now, even if you think back about Avraham's various brachot, it really always was brachot of land of Israel and children. That was the brachot which kept coming again and again. That brachot is given to Yaakov. He's not dressed up. It's not Purim. We know exactly who it is. No questions over here. Now, when Yaakov runs away and he's got all the brachot in the world and he goes to sleep underneath the ladder. So, sorry, he goes to sleep under the star. He sees this ladder, has this dream, angels going up and down. Okay, now we start with our angels. And God speaks to him. What's the first remarkable thing? The fact that God is speaking to him. We never have God speaking to him before. And maybe even in Yaakov's inner heart, he's thinking, you know, hold it. Was my father right? My mother right? Was I right listening to my mother? I just now deceived my father. Did I do the right thing? Did I do the wrong thing? God speaks to him. That's incredible. What does God say? And just to upset you, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to do this. He would ask, and what didn't God say? So I'll ask that as well. He didn't ask in this context, but it's very important here. What did God say and what didn't God say? Because what God didn't say, as they say, so ekad leva shamayim. What he didn't say is what Yaakov hears very loud and clear. What does God say to him? First thing he says, the land you're lying on is holy land, and this land I'm going to give to you. And your children will burst out into many, many children. So what does he give him? He gives him the berachot avraham. He gives him what Yitzchak gave him when he knew that it was Yaakov. What doesn't he give him? He doesn't say anything about the bracha that he stole, which means anything about power and anything about money. There we have complete silence on God's part. A matter of fact, God speaks to Yaakov a number of times along the way, never comes back and says, sure, the bracha you stole, it's yours, no problem. Which of course leads to another issue. The fact that you stole a bracha, I mean, what's a bracha? A bracha is that I go and say, you should have divine abundance. You should have Shefa Eloki. Does God have to sign off on it?
No.
Is God's hands tied and say, oh, sorry, somebody gave a bracha, I have to listen? Right? As they say, God doesn't work for us. God can do what God wishes. And over here, Yaakov's response after waking up is, if you take care of me and you protect me and give me, what does he ask for? Wealth and power? What does he say? Clothing on my back and bread on my plate, bare minimum of both. I'll give you back 10%. Just give me the bare minimum. Yaakov understands what God didn't say. So now, in Yaakov's mind, these brachot that he stole, are they his or are they not his? And that's why I said, sorry, I took 40 minutes now of introduction, but now we get to our parsha. So what does Yaakov do? So he starts off by saying, My master Esav. What else does he continue to say? Your servant Yaakov. What else does he do? When he finally meets him, what does he do? It's very interesting. What does he do when he meets him? He bows down to him. What's the significance of that? Those are the words of the bracha. Your mother's sons will bow down to you. So what does Yaakov do? He bows down to Esav. What else does he do? And this is the most dangerous of all. He gives him gifts. He gives him things, which means this Rashi is incredibly important. Not in love on Garti v'tarig mitzvah. That's cute. I'm sorry. No offense to Rashi. That's cute. But the more important point is that first part of the Rashi, the brachot haven't worked for me. In love on Garti, but now, on the other hand, if I'm not mistaken, Yaakov may be saying something else. And this would be far more audacious, if I'm right. If he says, I was a stranger in another land, what else is he saying? This is my land. Eretz Yisrael is mine. He said that would be far more audacious when you're about to have a conflict with Esav, which means, what is he saying? Again, I don't know if I'm right, but this rings true to me. Esav had Kivud Av. Yitzchak wanted to give Esav one set of brachot, wants to give Yaakov another set of brachot. Esav has to accept that. That's how Esav is wired. Esav has to accept that. Again, you can argue with me on this. But what does he say to him? He says to him, the bracha that he wanted to give you, I'm giving back to you. I am giving you back your bracha. By the way, am I overstating this? No, of course I'm not overstating it, because he says it. It's great when it's literally black and white. In source number 7, Perek Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Tet. Vayomer Esav, he tries to give him his bribes, tries to give him all of these things back. Vayomer Esav, Yeshli Rav. What does it mean, Yeshli Rav? Yeshli Harbe. Achi, Ye Lecha Asher Lach. By the way, that's also remarkable. How does Esav respond to Yaakov? Achi, my brother. He feels brotherhood here. Now that itself is quite interesting. Vayomer Yaakov, Ana imatzasi chen beinach lachachta mincha tibyadi, kakein re'iti panech kirot p'nei elokim v'tirtzeini, kachna ad birkati, take my bracha. I know he's talking about the produce, but to use the word bracha in this context, does that at least strike you as interesting? I mean, of all words to use, and yes, language is quite important. When Yaakov is trying to give gifts back to Esav, what does he say? Tikach et birchati, take my bracha. But of course, this is what Yaakov's whole strategy is. Call him master, bow down to him, give him whatever produce Yaakov seems to have, and says, tikach. Take the bracha, which I took from you. But, as I said, it seems to me that Yaakov is coming back to the land of Israel, because of all that Yaakov wanted to do, and he wanted to if he wanted to not accept the bracha that Yitzchak gave him the land of Israel, he doesn't have to come back. No, God told him to come back. It's time to come back. This is your land. You need to go back there. And when he says, I'm lovum garti, that's what I'm saying. I mean, what streams out in that pasuk, and that's what I'm asking you to do, read through this whole parasha, the whole Yaakov-Esav conflict, read it through the lens of the previous brachot, and then we'll understand what is being said. It's not between the lines. This is not between the lines. What's being said by the words being used over here, and again, the only thing you can accuse me of is that I didn't find commentaries that actually said this, and that's not my responsibility. Nope. We'll write it. And that's why we have to write books. So people say, "Where is it written someplace?" Yeah, it's written. Who wrote it? Some rabbi wrote it, said it. And all of this leads to what I said before we started. The truth is that I'm very disappointed in Esav. Esav's a great disappointment. And in order to understand what I'm about to say, you need to channel your inner Esav. Can you do this? Esav is coming to meet Yaakov. Now, how does he come to meet him? He makes some preparations. Now I needed the timing. What are the preparations he comes? He comes with 400 men. Why are there 400 men? So it's possible that it's a marching band. That's why we needed the music now. So, right. Do any of us think that that's why this was a marching band that he brought? Does anyone think that this was a marching band? No. This is not a marching band. He comes and brings 400 men with him, an army with him, because he wants to give Yaakov a proper homecoming. And again, I'm going to say it again. Channel your inner Esav now. So what happens when you see Yaakov? So the Esav that we've come to love and respect and to fear is an Esav who we believe till this point wants to kill Yaakov. Yaakov believe he wants to kill Yaakov. All the preparations that Yaakov are doing here. And yes, it's so interesting. Rashi points out he prays and he prepares strategically. Divide the camps. If one gets killed, the other will escape. So you have military strategy. You have theological praying to God. What else do you have? And the other thing is the old Jewish way. He tries to bribe Esav and tries to send him some gifts. And I said before, that's the most dangerous of them, because this could be a trigger. This could be a trigger. Because if Yaakov sends him 10% of what he has, and remember it's interesting, he said, I'll send it off to God, but now he's going to give it off to Esav. Let's just say he gives him 10% of what he owns. So if, again, channel your inner Esav. So you get this gift. Whoa, this is great. This is so nice. Or do you maybe think of it a little differently? I know somebody who told me last week when I was in America that he was a victim of ID fraud, but the person who did it was his former business partner. And was their former business partner who had their social security number, who had their information, opened up a whole bunch of credit cards, spent all kinds of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and one of the things that he later found that she had given him was a very, very generous, beautiful wedding present, which he paid for. So do you say, wow, that was just so nice to get me a present out of the money that he stole from me? Or you're failing in your job today. What would the Esav that we know? Yaakov sends him a gift, and Esav should be looking and saying, "You're sending me a gift? This is mine." You remember the speech that Lavan gave? Everything is mine. Can you imagine Esav giving the same kind? And again, even if there's this rumor about that Leah was supposed to marry Esav is there. The women are mine. Everything is mine. Again, the same speech Lavan gave. And Lavan, by the way, also says, I would have brought a band. Right? So, the Esav we love and respect, he would take a rusty nail and drive it into Yaakov's eyes and kill him and bite it. And you know what? That's what Rashi tells us. It's just an upshot. Rashi says is that he goes, he tries to bite his neck and so on. Do you remember what the Pasuk actually says? And as I said, this is what's so disappointing. Back in source 7, source number, Pasuk Dalid, Vayaretz Esav lekrato, Vayichabkehu, he embraces him, Vayipol Tzavarav, he falls on his neck, Vayishakehu, and he kisses him, Vayivku. So the time you finish with Rashi, he bit his neck, all his teeth fell out, and that's why he was crying. It's very nice. It's a very nice interpretation. It's a very nice interpretation. It's a very nice interpretation. But it has nothing to do with what it actually says in the Chumash. What it says in the Chumash is so out of character and so surprising. Esav is preparing for war, and in the end, Esav becomes a wuss and he melts down. And again, how can you not be disappointed in Esav? We wanted bloodshed. I mean, of course, we didn't really want bloodshed, but Esav, something happened. Oh,
famous machlokes. The Adurah Esav served Yaakov, and some say.
Right, so Esav was such a rasha, he went against the halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. Okay, so I understand. Right, so I'm saying that something goes wrong now. 10 minutes left. What goes wrong when we look at source number 4, which is the night before, Yaakov divides everybody, two different camps, everything is all ready. I don't know. Do you think Yaakov got a good night's sleep that night? Or there's a little adrenaline, a little fear, a little something else going on? And then we find, Vayivater Yaakov levado, Yaakov was all by himself. Vayavik ishimo adlot ha-shachar. And a man wrestles with him until the morning, which means Yaakov has nothing better to do the night before than to go get himself into a fight. Now we all know that Rashi tells us in source number 5, Pirish Rabotenu, Shehu, ignore the Lamed, that's from the Siftei Chachamim, Shehu, Sarah Shel Esav. that the person who, Yaakov, gets into a fight with his Harosh Elesa, which again is quite ironic. Before they're born, they get into a fight, B'yidur Tzitzu. Over here, the night before the conflict, the power of Esav and Yaakov get into a fight with one another. The next morning, somehow everything is resolved. Now, of course, you can tell me that whatever is resolved in the next morning is because of something which took place now. Again, that's a fair comment, but still, it's interesting that Yaakov gets into a fight, a confrontation now, but when he meets the real Esav, everything somehow gets worked out. The pasuk itself is an impossible pasuk. No offense, but it's written very, very poorly, or written deliberately enigmatically. Vayivater Yaakov levado. Yaakov is all by himself. Vayivagish shemod lo teshachar, and a man wrestles with him until the break of day. Now, there's a clause which is missing. Okay, I could add it. Yaakov was all by himself, and out of the shadows a form appeared, right? And it was a large man who comes and he goes lunging for Yaakov and wrestles with him. I mean, there's something missing. If Yaakov is all by himself, then who's with him? I mean, the other protagonist needs to make an entrance. Again, we want it more dramatic if we can. But the other protagonist is missing. The next pasuk just continues along the same way, again being deliberately and enigmatic. Vayar ki lo yachalo, he saw he couldn't defeat him. Vayar ki lo yachalo, he saw he couldn't defeat him. Uriella, would you let a writer get away with that?
No.
I know my editor would not let me get away with that. I've already been behavior modified by things like this, that you have to put names in. And he was hurt in his thigh. Again, that's not the way that one writes. You have to write who are you talking about. And then, and Yaakov's thigh was hurt when he wrestled with him. Can anybody improve the editing on this pasuk? And the answer is yes. Every one of us can improve this. And then you have to ask ourselves, so why is this being written in this type of a difficult way? He said, let me go for the dawn breaks. Who's speaking? Is it Yaakov? He's got to go fight Esav? Is it the angel, we're told, who has to go and perform whatever duties angels perform in the morning? I'm not going to let you go unless you give me the bracha. So now the bracha again appears. The bracha is the issue. But again, who's speaking? What's going on? All of this, as I said, remains completely enigmatic. He goes, what's your name? See, you know what part of our problem is? When we read this, A, we already know it's Sarah Shal Esav, so we understand everything. But B, a Jew's walking down the street and somebody attacks him. It doesn't bother any of us. We expect it. Why was he attacked? Because he's a Jew. Meaning, we don't have to go and ask ourselves, why is somebody attacking him? He doesn't even know his name. He just saw his yarmulke. And he goes, what's your name? This itself is fascinating. An unknown, unnamed protagonist attacks Yaakov for unstated reasons. He says, what's your name? He says, my name is Yaakov. But you're my low Yaakov, Yamarod Shemecha, Kim Yisrael. You're not Yaakov, you're Yisrael. Now, again, I want to pause. Let's say this is Sarah Shal Esav. What are the very, and by the way, Sarah Shal Esav, the name of Sarah Shal Esav is called Samael. Do you know names of any other angels? Gabriel, Michael, Raphael. You know what's real interesting about that? The next pasuk he says, name isn't Yaakov. Sorry, continue. Shaki'im Yisrael. Your name is Yisrael. Do you realize the name Yisrael is the name of an angel? That we just now, again, Yaakov is fighting the power of Esav, and Yaakov now just became something else. He became also the power of Yaakov. He just now became Yisrael. As strange as what I just now said sounds, the name Yisrael fits into the names of the other angels, Gabriel, Michael, Raphael. So that shouldn't be lost on us, because I think that's... I knew you'd get the wrong one. That should be one of the things which alerted Chazal in terms of the issue that this is Sarah Shal Esav. There are other issues as well, which I don't want to point out right now. At the Yaakov then asks him, what's your name? Right? Why are you asking me my name? Which clearly means that he was Jewish. Esav is considered to be a Mumu Yisrael. So even his sar is a Mumu Yisrael. Because he answers like a Jew. He answers the question with the question. And he gives him the bracha. So here you also have another word like that. Ki ra'iti Elohim panim apanim v'tinatzel nafshi. I saw God face to face, and my life was saved. When did you see God? Which is also a little strange. V'yizrach lo ha'shemesh kasher varo panoel v'hut sole al yirecho. Al-Kain, and he goes out limping. Al-Kain lo yechob b'nei Yisrael gidnasha, and therefore Jews don't eat the gidnasha. My kids would say, ma kesher? What is one thing to the other? Yaakov got into a fight and he hurt his sciatic nerve, that's what they say, and therefore Jews don't need it. I just say Baruch Hashem that he didn't break his ribs. That's right. That's my takeaway. That's right. That's my takeaway from this parsha. Now, I want to make a suggestion, which I won't have time to defend. And that is, I want to take it at face value, but it's really what I think Rashi means, what Chazal mean. Yaakov's all by himself, and he wrestles with an ish. I'll add one comment from the Zohar. The Zohar says that this struggle took place, source 10, listen to the Zohar, because this will surprise you that all this is here. Source 10. Uchidein, Ahadar Esav Apitropas Adar Yaakov. Esav was supposed to be the Apitropas of Yaakov. What does that mean? Esav was supposed to take care of Yaakov. I mean, that's the guardian. He's supposed to be the one to take care of Yaakov. The Yaakov Lobadvusha Vukutse. I'm skipping a Yavon Adoni Lefnei Avodav. And skipping Lino. Ematai, when. Okay, sorry. The Yoshav Vayomahu Esav Ladarko. Esav goes back. Where does he go back to? He goes back to the Seir. Ematai, when did this happen? Bishat Ne'ilah. It took place at Ne'ilah. So it's fascinating. The Zohar decides that the confrontation of Yaakov and Esav took place on Yom Kippur. At which point did they separate ways? At the time of Ne'ilah. So at which point did Yaakov wrestle with whoever he wrestled with? It was the night before. What's the night before? It's called Nidre night, Yom Kippur Eve. So what happens in Yom Kippur? So I want to say that Yaakov wrestles with himself. Now, before you say anything else, it's easy to say this, but you have to defend it. Yaakov wrestles with himself because he has a very, very simple question that he asks himself. And that question is, who am I? Am I Yaakov or am I Esav? Why would he be asking this question? Because Yaakov has changed. He used to be an Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. And now, and he says it himself, I left with my stick in hand. I came back, Shnei Machanot. Which means Yaakov has transformed into something else. And this goes back to, even though I said that maybe God didn't want to give him the bracha, and maybe Yaakov still is very different than he was before, but it's not what he is, it's what he isn't. He doesn't seem to be an Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim anymore. Yaakov lo frayer. Yaakov yodei listader. Yaakov can deal with the lovins of the world now. Lovin can rip him off. He knows how to manipulate it right back that he wins out. This is not the same Yaakov that we met all those years before. Yaakov has undergone a transformation, but part of his transformation is very troubling to him. And again, by the Zohar setting on Yom Kippur, do you know why? I'll tell you soon why he does it. The Zohar sets this up as Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a time that we go through our own personal cheshbon nefesh. Who am I? What I've become, and what has happened to me, and what happened to the person that I think I am. I just don't look that person, but get more melodramatic. You know, as he passes through the river, right? He passes through the water, and he sees his vision of himself, and he sees something he never saw before. He looks so much more like Esav than he ever realized before that he gets very, very frightened. And at that point is when he has this whole struggle. But I do want to point out one verse which may be able to support this. There's a verse which is used, which describes, and it's in source 8, when Yaakov finally gets very, very wealthy after he manipulates everything. Do you remember what the verse says to describe Yaakov? Source 8. The man birthed forth exceedingly, and he had all of these possessions. What term does it use for Yaakov? It didn't call him Yaakov there. What did it call him? Ha'ish. Yaakov was all by himself, and a man wrestles with him. But what is the man? That's Yaakov who became the man. Yaakov who became somebody else. Yaakov who became something like Esav, and this frightens him. Now, I want to pause here. I think that this is exactly why Esav doesn't kill him. What does Esav say to him? Something unexpected. Come, let's go march together. Why? And he calls him Achi. Because Esav just now got a gift. First, he got a lot of bribes, which are very important, but he just got a gift. What was the gift that he got? He got a brother. He never had a brother before. I know he had a brother. He got a brother now. What brother did he get? The fight between the two of them was always a fight of ideology. Ish tam yoshev olim or ish tzayit, ish sadeh. Yaakov has now become an ish sadeh. Yaakov is no longer the ish tam yoshev olim. Esav looks and says, Achi, my brother, come, let's join forces. What our father had said all those years before, let's go. Right, let's go and do it. Right. Let's go and join forces, become one. Esav's response is one of love, and he hugs him and he kisses him, and they both cry, let's join forces. Yaakov says, all the stuff that I have slows me down. Esav lives for the stuff. Yaakov has the stuff, but Yaakov is willing to give it away. It slows me down. That, by the way, is the Gidonosha. Hurting the thigh slows me down. He says it the next day when he meets up with Esav, this slows me down. This is part of the resolution. Yaakov is a name connected to Esav and subservient to Esav. But Yaakov has now become somebody. Again, the curse of the blessing that he took, right? You like that sentence? The curse of the blessing that he took is that now he has to live Esav's life. Living Esav's life is not so easy. Living Esav's life is a life involved in stuff. He's willing to give it all back. He's willing to bow down. He's willing to give it back. He's willing to say, take the bracha. All that he's willing to separate from. But nonetheless, Yaakov has become somebody else at this point. The resolution over here is in order to find meaning for the stuff, to give kedusha to the Chomer, in order to use it in the service of God. How did the Zohar know that this was Yom Kippur? Go back to source number 10. The Zohar continues and says, how do I know it was Yom Kippur? It says, it's parish me'ama kadisha, v'kut shebrich l'shavik l'choveyun, v'chipir alayhu, God forget. By the way, what the Zohar is saying between the lines over here is the whole process between Yaakov and Esav is a process that gets played out every year in Yom Kippur with the Seir Lazazel. The gifts that were given to Esav is the same thing as the Seir Lazazel, which is given off to, what's the Seir? Esav is Seir. What does he live? It's Seir. The Seir Lazazel is connected to the gifts. It's the Shochad, which is given to the Perikot Lezer, which we're not going to have time to read. In source number 9, it says, how does Yom Kippur work? We give a bribe to Samael, who's the Saru Shel Esav. It's this gift that we give to the Sarah Shesav, which means on Yom Kippur, when you take the two goats, which, by the way, what do the Mishnah say about the two goats? They need to look like twins. They need to look like twins. Echad LaShem, the Echad LaZazel. And that means they can look so similar, and that's exactly what happened here. Yaakov looks far more like Esav than we ever imagined, and Esav looks far more like Yaakov than we ever imagined, but still there's a difference. No, I didn't get to it yet. How does Zohar know that it was Yom Kippur? Aside from the fact that everything about Yom Kippur fits into this struggle, how does it know it? It continues and it says, since the Mekatreg accepted the gifts. I mean, that's it. That's the Yom Kippur theme right there. Because the Mekatreg took the gifts, the Itparish Minayu, and separated from him, Boy Kud Shebrichu L'machde B'Binyoy. God comes to celebrate, he's happy. Maktiv, and what does it say right afterwards? B'Yaakov Nosa Sukkota. And Yaakov went to Sukkot. So when does Sukkot take place? Right after Yom Kippur. That was the sense that...
Where else it says that?
Yes, when they left the... okay. So, on Yom Kippur, we struggle with life and death. Who am I? Right? Who am I? You know, how will I become? Mi yichye v'lo aleinu mi yomus. We get to Sukkos. What do we do on Sukkos? On Sukkos, on the one hand, we leave our house, we live in a sukkah. Yaakov built Sukkos. This is the first sukkah. What else do we do on Sukkos? We take the Arba Minim and we pray for rain. We pray for Gashmias. We pray for Geshem. So at the exact same time that we pray for Geshem, we leave our houses to say, yeah, we need Geshem, we need quality of life, but we know it's not all that important. Which means this dichotomy between the physical and the spiritual, or taking the physical, needing the physical, and what do you do with the physical, that's what we do on Sukkot. On the one hand, we pray for Geshem, on the other hand, we say, yeah, but we don't take it so seriously. It's not everything. It's not everything. We have more important things in life. And what's more important is now how do we take things and elevate them? The idea of the Gidonosha is I can eat meat, I can be involved in a gashmi, a physical world, but I have to slow down. By the way, taking the Gidonosha out is a very, very slow process. I can eat that animal so slow that in America they don't even do it. They just give the whole, in Israel they take it out. But to take out the good and ush is a very slow process, which means you want to be involved in the physical world. It slows you down. I'm saying that's the metaphor with the leg. And it's interesting that Yaakov's name from the beginning, based upon Akiv, that Yaakov's from the beginning, it has to do with the leg. Over there when he has the struggle in utero, when he comes out, it's the leg. Over here when he has the struggle in this scene before he meets Esav, it's again, something takes place in the leg. When he meets up with Esav, he says, everything, we go slower. We can't go so quick. Right? Slow down, you move too fast. Okay. That's it. We should stop. With the resolution over here between Yaakov and Esav becomes as follows. I can't take a hint. The resolution between Yaakov and Esav is that Yaakov takes the bracha and it ends up destroying his life, and he goes away. Now he has to come back. Now he's coming back to take what's his. He's coming back to take Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, whether the other bracha worked or not, I'm leaving this as an open question right now. It works to a certain extent. Does he really have power? Does he really have possessions? I don't know. But the possessions that he does have, Yaakov learns how to channel it and how it becomes now. He struggles with the divine and struggles with things of this world. That's what Yisrael becomes. We really are that ladder with its feet on the ground and its head in the sky. And Yaakov, maybe, instead of just seeing the angels going up and down, Yaakov becomes one of those angels, Yisrael, and be able to go up as well and to take what's on the ground and bring it up towards Shemayim.